This is the Nomad Futurist Podcast, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and transformation. Connect with us, share your thoughts with us at nomadfuturist.com. Let's get this started. Here are Phil and Nabil.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Nomad Futurist. This is your co-host, Nabil Mahmood, currently from Scottsdale, Arizona.
This is your co-host, Philip Koblenz, still from Montclair, New Jersey.
Jeff Barber. I'm with Bloom Energy. I'm sitting in my home office here in beautiful Roseville, California.
Looks like you're hovering above a very interesting building.
Yes. It's a 100 megawatt Bloom Tower there, right there.
Well, we'll get to that Bloom Tower in just a minute. Jeff, before we get started, could you share what you do these days with our audience?
Sure. I'm vice president of global data centers for Bloom Energy. Bloom has been around for a little over a decade now, went public in 2018, dabbled in data centers, I would say, and they would come across opportunities. About a year ago, they decided to really focus on it. And so they hired me to build out a team of data center experts. And that's what we have now. So we speak the language.
All right. So now going back in time, just for a bit, how did you dabble into the data infrastructure space?
No, even further back. What were you like as a baby?
Very handsome, much thinner, more hair.
So yeah, let's sit back in time for a bit. So I see that you've got a human resource degree from California State University, Sacramento. From that to being in the data center segment, could you share a very high level about that journey?
Yeah, like many journeys, a lot of accidents, a lot of tripping along the way and falling off of cliffs. And it actually started right before I went to Sacramento State. I actually began college my first few years at Chico State, which is a little bit north. I was hell bent on being a construction major, and I was a carpenter. I was a woodworker in school. I used to make custom doors and cabinetry and all of that. And Butte County, where Chico's located, was the first in the nation to go bankrupt. And I was paying my own way through school at the time and obviously needed a job, but there was no building going on. So my buddy called me. He said, "Hey, you can come work for the California State Lottery. You can work in operations on this thing called the mainframe. And you could be a tape monkey," which means I learned to do backups. Didn't know what the hell that meant at the time, but he said, "They'll pay for school if you work graveyard shift." So I said, "Fantastic." So I went to move back to Sacramento, enrolled at Sac State, and went to school in the morning and worked all night on the data center floor. And back then, the mainframe operators like myself and eventually many computer operators also did all the ops. So we did all the procedures for testing the gens and replicating data. I'm talking about, this is in the early to mid 90s. So storage and data replication back then were fairly difficult to do. So learned all about ops, all about all kinds of obsolete technology that's now long gone. And from there, I went to the IT side of the house. I went to work for Hewlett Packard and then eventually EMC, which is data storage and data movement acquired by Dell. And we acquired VMware during my tenure there as well. And the reason that's very relevant is when you learn how data moves and is protected and is replicated, stored from the application within a database or in a file system, it's your first hint as to why are data centers located where they are many times, right? What is latency? Why does that matter? So learned all about that for a good 12 years. From there, I went on to consult and mostly in the marketing space, go-to-market strategies, building sales forces, and was working with a developer, brand new developer to the U.S. They had a property in Sacramento, and we did a great job leasing that property up. This was a tier 3 and plus 1, very traditional data center, and I went to work for them. And so I was a developer for a few years, building and operating and leasing facilities. So what started as being in the data center, that I would fill the data center with EMC and HP and Oracle, companies like that, the IT stack, moved on to building them and working with people who built them and operated them. Bloom came knocking about 18 months ago. Very interesting role because I was feeling the power crunch myself. We were not able to secure power in many, many places across the nation. And this was about 18 months ago now. And it's only gotten worse, as you guys know. So that brings us up to current. I'm old, so I'm sorry for the long-winded answer, Nabil.
No, that's actually pretty quick and easy. I was expecting a lot more firecrackers, more story there.
Yeah, clearly, that's well rehearsed. That sounds like you've given the elevator pitch of what you've been doing for the last 30 years.
Yeah, not quite 30, but pipe down. All right. Pretty close.
So here's what I love about your experience. One is that we tend to, when we talk to students, we talk about how the data center industry, digital infrastructure industry has a bunch of sub verticals. And we usually have to talk about that by talking about different people, because usually it's different people that encapsulate those verticals. Most of those verticals are in your experience. You've gone from operations to sales to strategy and go-to-market and marketing and everything in between. And that kind of 30,000-foot view is remarkable. And I don't think you could have predicted the value of kind of construction background in what data centers are. But I wonder if you can give us a little bit of background of like what drew you to construction and whether you had in your younger days an interest in IT and computers that made the transition to a kind of IT environment from a construction focus any easier, or what those challenges looked like.
I was drawn to fine woodworking, I would say, boy, when seventh grade, 12 years old, approximately. First wood shop class. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I was asked to teach the class because I was 18 and times were different back then. Liability had a very different meaning. Basically protect the freshman from cutting your fingers off. So I always loved it. Went to school in Chico and immediately got a job with a lumber company who had a cabinet shop and a door shop. During that time, in the summers and when I had time, I would do what's called piecework on the construction side of the house. Maybe installing those doors or building decks or building a fence. So I was always just had a natural interest in it.
That come from anyone? Were your parents in construction? Did you have family that were in construction?
No. I don't know where the hell it came from, to be honest with you. I am a handy guy for sure. But if we back up, I'm sure around November of 1981, when I was turning 11, we did get an AT&T IBM clone, right? The first kind of PC. And I saved up my money and I was able to buy a Winchester hard drive, 10 megabytes on the hard drive. That was big time. So yeah, I was always interested at that level, interested in software and how things work. I'm not a coder. I know enough to be dangerous and I know what a file system is and what a database is. And so I did have that kind of confluence of those two worlds, right? And I will tell you that the most valuable aspect of my background was not the construction side. It was the IT side. If you understand what the workload is your tenant or prospective tenant a social media company? Or are they relational databases using an Oracle backend, maybe with SAP in front of it or something like that? You can understand where they need to go. Where should they build? Where should they lease? They can also understand why does machine learning AI workloads, why is it latency insensitive typically? Why does that not matter? What does that mean for where data centers are going? Will they be much more modular? Will they just go to where the power is cheap and available? It's going to make up a significant portion of the market. There's a lot of hype right now. It's still not anything as compared to the typical Intel pizza box type of infrastructure, either 15 kW a cabinet type of design, but that helps you prepare for what's coming. It helps you set expectations. It helps you make decisions about where to build if you're a developer and how to build. As you guys know, it's very good when you can speak the tenant's language more than anything. Lots of people don't realize that you can have a developer, a Vantage or a Stack or a Compass or any of those great companies, but at the end of the day, the tenant is going to drive a lot of the conversation.
What's interesting is twofold. One is the idea of knowing what you're selling to have credibility is
bingo.
It's incredible how simple that concept is and how difficult it is for people to recognize that the best salespeople are the ones that worked in operations that speak the language of their prospective client. But mm-hmm. You used two words in your initial description. One, and they sounded like they were related to each other and they weren't. One was operations and one was obsolete, which are that does not stand for obsolete. But
no, it does not. I'm referring to being Novell certified and knowing DECnet and all these obsolete technologies that are long gone.
Yeah, right. But I think what your description kind of proves is that there's no such thing as obsolete experience. So once you have that kind of access to operations, the underlying technology might change, but the understanding of how one element of a particular piece of infrastructure interacts with another element of infrastructure, that relationship stays the same. So if you can take that kind of 30,000-foot view and recognize the kind of interoperability of all these mechanisms, the same experience that you had working for the lotto in the early 90s could apply to AI and the workloads that we're seeing today, because inevitably the areas of infrastructure interact with one another in the same fashion. So I think a lot of people think that, oh, you don't know anything because you were exposed to operations in the late 80s and early 90s, when in reality, the relationship between all of those components are very much the same.
You hit it on the head, Phil, using a key word there, which is the number one cause of downtime, and that's interoperability. If I look from an IT stack perspective, my many years at EMC and Hewlett Packard, the data center was a place where we put our gear, and we would make very important decisions based on location, based on even where in the building. It was extremely latency sensitive. You must learn, you're replicating data, you must learn all about telephony and latencies and different carriers and different, how many milliseconds are added by a router hop. These drive your decisions on where my customers were going to lease, right? So it was foundational. I think if you're a salesperson that doesn't know what you're selling, you're probably not in the right industry. That's first rule of sales is know your product. Absolutely.
Well, that's a good starting point. All right. So just out of curiosity, I mean, I'm still stuck on the woodworking and the human resources and technology space. Walk me through, you've transitioned from woodworking, you've got a career path in the technology sector, you choose to go to CSU with a major in human resources. How is it all interconnected?
Well, first and foremost, to get that concentration in human resources, you first have to have a BS in business, right? So that was done first. And I had a couple of aspirations maybe to be a lawyer until I actually looked into what it meant. So I was planning to go be an employment law lawyer briefly. But it was a very, very good focus, having already completed my business degree, because just early on through a series of fortunate events, or unfortunate, depends on how you look at it, I was managing teams at a very young age, in my opinion, looking back, 30, 40 people at 26 years old, most of which were much older than me.
You were teaching classes as an 18-year-old, so it's probably not, it's par for the course.
That was a function of some unfortunate events with one of our teachers in high school, so I was kind of thrown into that. But I can't go into that story. It's quite sordid. But it did help me quite a bit in just managing people, knowing how to hire, or at least having a foundation. Knowing how to recruit, where to recruit. These are the days when you'd have to go to employment fairs, right? Pre-LinkedIn, and you'd have students coming up and you'd have internships. And I knew what those words meant because of my concentration.
Where did you put the selfies? When you had the fairs, where did the selfies go?
They were live selfies.
You'd have to have, I guess you'd just carry around a photo album full of Polaroids of pictures of yourself with everyone you've ever met.
That's right. Carved on stone tablets.
There you go. All right. Makes too much sense. All right. So go ahead and now talk about your family and upbringing for a bit, if you don't mind. I caught just over there about you buying a laptop and or a computing device early on in your life. Was family in the technology space? What did your mom and dad do? And or your siblings? What were you exposed to?
It is why, well, I was exposed to some, raised by a single mother. But she was 35 years at Hewlett Packard. And Hewlett Packard, back in the day when Bill and Dave were still there, was a very forward-looking company. They had on-site daycare. They had flexible hours, open door policies. This is in the 70s. So we moved from San Jose, Palo Alto area, Silicon Valley area, to Roseville, California. That's where I essentially grew up in my early teens and still live there today. Because that at the time was one of the biggest sites HP had in the world. They actually drove this area to be one of the most highly connected fiber hubs in the world. It brought in Intel into Folsom and Oracle is here and WebEx was here. So I was raised in that environment. She wasn't a technologist, but I was always around it. Some of the first calculators, the 35Cs and 12C financial calculators and all that. They were around my kitchen table because she worked in that group. And it's also the era, if you think back then, when the first viable video games were coming out, right? My friends all had Ataris and I would save up and I had an Atari 2600. And then we eventually started buying a Commodore 64 and we'd sit there with a book and we'd figure out how to make a dog or something on the screen, some graphics pixelated thing. So there was a foundation there simply because I believe the time I was raised in. And it was very novel and very new, very interesting. And then the PC, I even had an Apple II and an Apple II Plus from friends that my mom worked with. They'd let me use them and things like that. And we did have at one time, I wouldn't call it a laptop, but I had a compact system with a handle on it that I could put the keyboard on top and carry it around. And it was about a suitcase size with an 8-inch screen. So was I obsessed with it? No, I was into football and baseball and all those things, but I definitely had a foundational understanding of what was going on. What is DOS for those ancient people that remember that? There when Windows was born, there when Apple had the first mouse. And you said, what the heck is that? So always raised around it, yes. But single mother, she had to work a lot. Latchkey kid very early. And fortunately, I had a lot of good friends around me, a lot of good neighbors with a lot of computer gear. A lot of very smart people that worked at Stanford and Lockheed Martin at the time. And they always had the latest gear and would let me twiddle around on it.
So you're kind of like the OG of the digital native, basically, in a way.
Good game. Raised by HP childcare.
Sometimes, I mean, they were back in the day when all the company picnics were on the Packard Ranch, Dave and Lucille Packard. Eventually, their family founded the Monterey Bay Aquarium, many other things. So it was a great company, great culture. Back then, it was called the HP Way. Essentially, believe that everyone wants to do a good job. And if they're not, something else is broken. I think something we kind of need to bring back. I left right around the Harley Fiorina age, right before the Compaq acquisition, when things got a little crazy. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. How about siblings? Any siblings?
Yeah, I have a wonderful sister. Her name is Brenna. She works at the state of California, a little bit opposite of me from a technology perspective. Her and my mom, I get the phone calls quite often. Jeffrey, I shouldn't have clicked that link. Something broke my computer.
So you're the built-in family tech support too now.
I think we all are. We say this all the time, right? No matter where you get in your career, you're likely to be the head of tech support in your own family.
Yeah. Yes,
Jeffrey, I think I'm a Nigerian princess now.
Yes. I've won the Nigerian lottery. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you obviously have a very interesting background, and I think you're probably one of those people that we could potentially say that you're a unicorn in this space because of the diversity of experience that you bring forth from a technology stack, application stack, security, designing, building, operating data centers, and now being on the other end of it and working at Bloom. Where do you think we are as it entails to the amount of progress that we've made, and are we heading in the right direction with some of the challenges that we're walking ourselves into pertaining to energy in particular?
Yeah, we're at an inflection point, certainly, right? Taking many generative resources offline, dirty coal generating plants, without necessarily replacing them. I think the bigger issue is the lack of transmission. Just the bureaucracy and the expense tied up in new transmission lines is incredible. And as we're seeing, any of us in this industry, it's not uncommon to hear 7, 8, 10 year wait times when you're submitting for power for a data center. So how are we doing in that space? I think we're going in the right direction, but I think it's going to get a little bit worse before it gets better. You are seeing companies like Bloom on-site power generation. You're seeing SMRs. Right? You're seeing AWS investing in nuclear. We are certainly very busy at Bloom. So the developers with the blessing of the tenant, and I'll talk about that in a second, the developers are starting to realize that this is not a trick by the utility, that this time they're really not showing up. For many years, we would submit a request for power and the utility would say no, and then they'd come back around in 6 months and say, oh, never mind, we found you 30 megawatts. So we were definitely conditioned to believe that this was another one of those situations. Now I think we've reached the tipping point, or I know we have, where the developers are no longer relying on the utility. They're planning on them to not show up. And so that's good for on-site generation. It's a paradigm shift. Like I said earlier, the developer is, of course, great, but the tenant will drive the SLAs around the power quality and availability. And is it on site? Are they willing to pay higher lease rates when you need to build something like that tower behind me, right? That wasn't in the plans 10 years ago as data centers were being developed at 15 kW rack max, right? So we got a little ways to go, I think, Nabil, is how I would answer that.
Do you think that given the fact that a lot of these developers are now having to essentially take the generation of power into their own hands, is there a potential risk given the type of no matter what side of this fence you fall on, but the like federal regulations around utilities and how they're protected and how they're susceptible to outages and outside forces, et cetera. Is there some element of the regulations that are not necessarily taking into account the fact that you're going to decentralize power generation to a certain extent? Is that a risk?
Absolutely. Utilities are many times a government-endorsed monopoly definition, right? So there are reasons for that. I'm being cavalier. You don't want 50 different companies stringing wires across your city. So there are reasons for that in history. It is a challenge. Some places, much more than others. California can be difficult, but it's getting much easier. Virginia can be tough. And depending on the market, it's very much market dependent. And if the utility is a local utility, maybe it's a not-for-profit, they don't have the same business drivers as others. So it very much depends on what market you're in and whom you're speaking with, certainly.
And I imagine the potential risk of the federal government trying to stick their nose in and create some type of disruptive regulations, rules, in couched probably in the benefits of the population. But you never know, right, what's going to happen as far as those regulations go, because we're, I imagine, what, 15 steps ahead of where the federal government really understands what it is happening in our industry?
Absolutely. I think the SMRs, for instance, proliferate regardless of safety, of course, the feds are going to be involved in that, right? Yeah, absolutely agree. It is a risk. It's something that Bloom has been navigating for over a decade, though. And there's a positive side. If you look at the Inflation Reduction Act and ITC tax credits, in the case of Bloom, that's a 40% rebate to the developer because we're manufactured in the U.S. So it's 30% plus 10% domestic content. In some areas in the U.S., it's up to 50% if it's in an energy zone, right? These are areas that have been impacted by the reduction in coal or other generation sources. So that's where the federal government is absolutely helping us tremendously. Yeah, it's a very good thing.
So what do we need to do as a society, or as a matter of fact, let's start back. What do we need to do as a sector to address some of these challenges that are on the horizon?
I'll start. Stop using so much damn power.
Well,
which means everyone's got to stop tweeting or Xing.
Yeah, the other option is start actually utilizing what we've got in place. That's a part of the challenge as well. We've got so much stranded capacity and stranded compute out there that's not being fully utilized.
Yeah, you hit it on the head. And I will get my IT nerd hat on in a minute, but and go into that a little bit. I think that the markets have been so distracted for the last couple of years with this hoping for a unicorn flying over a rainbow with a bag of gold pooping out its butt. And that's just, we just can't go from burning coal to zero carbon. Hydrogen is certainly realistic. I don't know of a single data center able to run off of hydrogen in large quantities, 10, 20, 50 megawatt. It's not distributable today. There's not enough quantity. And then there's the economics. Is everyone willing to pay 300% more for their power or even more for them? So it will be there in the future when it reaches economies of scale. But today, and it's not from a Bloom employee perspective, we should be pragmatic and help turn the reputation of natural gas around. Natural gas is responsible for a massive amount of carbon reduction over dirtier sources. Whether you're combusting or not, Bloom is non-combustion, but it's much cleaner than the alternative. And it's there today. It's distributable. It's affordable. It's a known entity. And it can reduce carbon immediately. That, I like to use the example, it's a lot like your 401k. A ton of carbon reduced today has many benefits a decade from now. It's compounding. So investing in your early 20s, you're going to be in better shape than starting in your 60s. The carbon footprint is similar to that. So we should do that immediately. It's abundant. It's affordable. They've got a bad reputation. And as you can tell, that frustrates me. Now, that's actually what my chapter is about in the upcoming Greener Data book, becoming out on Earth Day. Now, let's talk about the IT stack real quickly and just data centers in general. I absolutely blame the tenant because the tenant will demand an N+1 architecture and the developer will react to what that tenant requires, right? So yes, we strand power on day one. As you guys know, you'll commission that facility, you'll turn over that data hall. Let's say it's a 8-megawatt data hall. They'll never get close to that 8 megawatts again. They'll never touch it. It's just a fact of life. So I believe it begins with communicating that to the tenants, not just the procurement side, but kind of like biofeedback. Like, okay, you realize that you're stranding 30 megawatts of power, and that's at this facility. You're never going to touch it. Just start educating on that. Not that it will magically lead to a paradigm shift, but we have to look at that whole model, the way in which the leases are written. Maybe it's power on demand, maybe it's software defined power, some way to throttle easily and redirect that excess somewhere else.
It's like the concept of selling back to the power grid when you build something. I'm not sure that infrastructure exists today, but we've talked about this with Nabil a lot, this concept of creating some type of communication to the market that the power is available here. Don't build out more and find a way to collaborate as a community, because frankly, it's what's best for business. Stranded power makes nobody any money. And Absolutely. It's also what's best for the environment. Why would you use more resources to create more stranded capacity in the future? Which is one of my biggest concerns with respect to this AI wave, is this concept of, we're not talking about stranding 8 megawatts or 30 megawatts now. You're talking about people commissioning 100 to 400 megawatt campuses and all over the place at a time early in the adoption of AI, when you can have, you know, distance between where inference is happening and where the actual learning is happening. And my sense is that that distance will shrink, and you'll have a lot of overbuilt capacity in places where it may be stranded. And I'm sorry, I'm a data center guy. I'm supposed to be like, rah, rah, AI, we're going to take over the world.
No, Phil, I think you hit it on the head. I do think it's an opportunity, however, meaning early on in the machine learning AI journey, like I mentioned earlier, it's not latency sensitive. So they can really be placed anywhere, but also they're non-transactional typically, which means, do you truly need N plus one? Can you just go N? Do you need to design to always to peak PUE? Or can you pick something a little more realistic and run a little hotter once in a while, right? We see that happening, obviously, with Meta and with other companies choosing to do that. I think that trying to apply traditional facilities and lease documentation, because at the end of the day, these are real estate people, right? This is why the industry got caught flat-footed with AI and ML, and why we're putting GPU clusters in very inefficient buildings. The market did not see this coming. But I do think there's an opportunity for the tenants and the operator to get together and say, look, I'm going to give you a theoretical 8 megawatts in this data hall. You're really only going to use 6. Let's structure the lease a little bit differently, where you give me 48 hours notice if you need that additional 2. Something like that. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, what will happen as well in the GPU and the ML AI world is, I don't know where it will come from, but remember in the open systems days when VMware was released, what did VMware do? It did 2 things. It virtualized a chip, which meant you could go from 15, 20% chip utilization to 80. Therefore, it's a better investment. You're getting more out of that same chip that you've already invested in. Most importantly, though, virtualization, not just VMware, but virtualization led to interoperability, something we mentioned earlier. I can have that Intel box believe it has this type of NIC card or this type of HBA in it, interoperating with a Cisco switch, but maybe that switch is really Juniper. In other words, I can create a virtual stack and test the interoperability. I think that will come for GPU workloads as well. I think this software will get much more intelligent, much more efficient. I don't know if you were at the NVIDIA conference last week, but Blackwell looks to be, actually could be less power in aggregate, but just making it more efficient, bolting on co-processors. So I think we're at the early stages and things will get better, but we have a big bump to get over here in the next 5 years, I would say.
Right. And what I think one of the problems we as just, this is a human issue more than it is a specific to our industry, is we have a hard time learning from past experience. So you think you're in this pendulum thing, you think you're at this inflection point, and I could replay whatever the podcasts were of 10 years ago, radio shows, I don't know. And everyone can talk about the cloud inflection point. And before that, it was the internet inflection point. And before that, it was, oh my God, the car came and we don't need buggy whips anymore. Yeah. And realizing, well, maybe that's a bad example because we still don't need buggy whips. But I think this concept that you need to build blindfolded as though you don't know what these moments in time look like is that same experience that you have by understanding that if you have experience with operations, it's never obsolete. If you understand how the systems work, if you understand what the motivation of the various components are, the people that are involved, and everything down, not to just the tenant, but the tenant's users and the tenant's users' users and what that tenant is likely to use, even on a percentage basis, because it's never as clear cut as it is today, because you're at such an early stage in AI. Of course, the chips are going to become more power efficient and less power hungry, because that's what happened with Intel chips. That's what happened with all of them. That's what happened on a per meg basis or per gig basis or per terabit basis or a per exabit basis or whatever.
Yeah, I do think because we are early on, you're seeing an acceleration in processing power faster even than Moore's Law back in the day. You're seeing it go just about straight
up. We need a new law. We're going to call it Barber's Law. Barber's Law is out. Forget about you, Moore. Barber has more experience than Moore ever had.
Don't say that.
I just said it. Who's going to stop me?
You did. No, I think you're spot on. I mean, I think, though, that the macro environment can make this a little bit different. What I mean by that is we have power generation coming offline, lack of transmission, and that's bidirectional. So why can't we sell back to many utilities? The lines can't handle it. The equipment's not at the site to be able to accept those electrons into the utility. So you have this power issue. You have power demand, obviously, increasing dramatically. You have some unbelievable software out there that's able to create this machine learning AI type of environment. And you have demand through the roof for space and with the hyperscalers, especially. So there's many things coming together. Like I said earlier, a confluence is happening that could make this a little bit more dramatic than in the past, right?
With all this demand and all this compute, we obviously know power is actually a major challenge today, and it will continue to potentially be a bigger challenge tomorrow. And of course, the regulation compliance being a part of it, like we've talked about briefly earlier today. Based on your experience and you being one of the influencers in the microgrid and the energy space, where do you think we will be in the next 5 to 10 years? And also, what steps do we need to start taking today to address these challenges ahead of us?
Yeah, good question. In 5 to 10 years in utility scale is a very short time frame. Right? We need over 1,000 miles of new transmission lines in the U.S. I think last year we built 90. So we're not making progress there. What I said earlier, I think still holds true. Let's take pragmatic steps. Obviously, on-site generation, if you must be in a geographic location, that pesky latency thing and data replication availability zones, you're going to have to generate power on-site. How will you do that? Certainly, we want it to be Bloom. But the market is looking closely at nuclear, aeroderivatives, turbines. You're creating NOx and SOx there. So is the ESG angle still out there? I think we need to be pragmatic and use the resources that are available, like natural gas, that I don't think we should be distracted believing that this magical new flux capacitor will come around, that we'll put one of these at the building and power is free and cheap and clean and perfect. It's not the way the world works.
Ironically, 1.21 gigawatts is not that much power anymore.
Not that much power. It's one meta site, right? But yeah, I think that Bloom is working hard to do this. This is what my team does, is primarily educate. We sell, of course, but when I started a year ago, the market believed we were a battery or we were backup power. And we're neither of those things. We're meant to be primary baseload power without combustion. So a lot of this has been re-education of the market, and they're starting to get it, not just with Bloom. The fact that utility is not going to show up, it's real this time, but your girl has left you. In Silicon Valley here, they sent out an official notice to all the developers. Don't ask for 10 years. We're not even going to review. They don't have it, right?
While she was leaving, she looked back at me while she was leaving at the last minute.
You say it, I have a chance. One in a million. Yeah.
Our goal with what we're doing, obviously, with the podcast and the foundation, is to try to get a lot of kind of new people looking at our industry as a potential career path. And if you heard the way Jeffrey Barber was talking, you would assume that Jeffrey Barber has a physics degree in electrical engineering and a master's in how the world of energy works. But as we've discussed, Jeff Barber has a human resources degree and is a woodworker.
That's right.
Like Jesus.
Like, a lot like that. I'm going to catch on fire.
Right. So I wonder if you could pinpoint like what characteristics you think you have that would resonate with someone that is a woodworker that might not think the data center space is for them, or the digital infrastructure space is for them. What characteristics that made you who you are fundamentally outside of technology were applicable to our industry?
It's a great question. Always curious about how things work. My favorite TV show is How It's Made. Always curious, like, how was this microphone made? And so I have a curious personality in general. And you mix that with someone who gets bored very, very, very easily, which is me. You need to find a diverse field, a diverse career. That's actually why I'm in sales. If you think about it, sales at the enterprise level, multi-hundred-million-dollar sales, even billion-dollar sales, I need, and my team needs to understand finance, the technology, the competitive landscape, logistics, construction, the deployment of one of our systems, or look at an SMR or something, right? It could be tens of millions of dollars. So when you go into the digital infrastructure space, as we referenced earlier, you really get to touch on everything in the stack, from the physical layer, the physical building. How does the cooling work? How do I prove it works? Well, what's CFD analysis? If you're willing to follow that trail of breadcrumbs, quickly you'll find yourself knowing quite a bit about not only the IT stack and the physical infrastructure, but operations as well. What does an SLA mean? Why does everyone keep talking about those? How are they written? So I'm very curious. I have short attention span. I get bored easily. So I like to have diverse things to do, whether that's with customers or even within my own company. Of a lot of interest, I would say. And that leap is not as difficult as most people would think. I think don't be intimidated by the acronyms and the fancy words.
Don't be scared. They're just letters.
They're just letters.
We might have to put a list of all the acronyms that we use in this conversation. What would you tell the young you if opportunity to live all of these experiences all over again? What would you do differently?
What would I do differently? I know I would have bought very different stocks over the last 20 years. I'm the perfect negative indicator. If you see me buying it, short it, go the other way.
All right. What's the last one you bought, just so we all know?
Wasn't NVIDIA. it was a great one. A great one called Fisker. I like to buy high and sell when it goes out of business.
This thing is so pretty. How could they not buy them?
Everybody's going to buy them. I would probably have written a little bit more, maybe been published a little bit more. I have published some papers out there and things like that. But I think that adds a ton of value to people coming up, breaking down what is data replication, right? What is data center operations, things like that. I wish I would have done more of that. There's always tomorrow, and I am doing more of that now, but it's something I really enjoyed. And I honestly probably would have taken a little bit more free time. I'm trying to do that now as well. Take PTO once in a while, enjoy PTC for an extra few days. It's not going to kill you. So take
two more, PTO and PTC.
There you go. And I just realized if we had an acronym list for this call, it could be the Mahmood Acronym Dictionary or MAP. I like that.
Perfect.
Wow, that's pretty creative. Well, of course, there's a reason why you're in sales and marketing.
I'm a marketing guy. Absolutely.
It was certainly phenomenal to have you on the platform. It's been way past overdue, and we can have this conversation for days on days. We'd love to host you back again, one of these again. But for now, this was Jeff Barber with Bloom Energy. Jeff, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, and thank you for sharing some insights.
And I don't know what you're talking about. You were able to focus on this for 45 minutes. You didn't look bored for 1 second.
Oh, you should see my leg. I'm fidgeting under there. I got pins of play.
When is it going to stop? When is it going to stop with the damn questions?
Little origamis. I'm a train wreck.
Thank you again. All right. Thank you for joining us. See you at the next one, Jeff.
Thank you. Train wreck out.
Well,
take care.
Bye-bye.
This has been great. Nothing lasts forever. Markets will come back. Currencies will rebound. Businesses will go on. And we will all move on. That could happen next week, next month, or next year. At Nomad Futurists, we're confident that those who prepare rather than panic will come out of this stronger. Thank you for joining us. This has been brought to you by Nomad Futurist. Check us online at nomadfuturist.org, and thank you for listening and subscribing, as well as your continued support.